Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
George Orwell once said, "Never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech which you are used to seeing in print." He said worn-out metaphors have lost all evocative power and are merely used because they save people the trouble of inventing phrases for themselves. We asked listeners which coronavirus metaphors were dominating where they happen to be.
When French President Emmanuel Macron addressed the nation on March 16th, he used the phrase, "Nous sommes en guerre," we are at war, six times.
Paul McEwen is a professor of media and communications at Muhlenberg College.
In the United States, there's a history of war rhetoric being used in cases like the war on terror, the war on drugs, but France doesn't have that same history. And so even though he used the phrase a lot, it had more of the sense of, we need to all come together, we need to work on this, this is really serious.
Germany's Angela Merkel has stopped short of calling it a war, listener Seth Knox reported.
I've seen the metaphor Kampf gegen das Virus, that is, a fight or a struggle against the virus. And so while Kampf could be used in a violent or militaristic sense to mean something like combat, it's more flexible in its meaning and usage than a term like war.
And a war implies an enemy. At a G7 meeting last week, world leaders failed to reach an agreement because the Trump administration wanted the official statement to refer to the illness as the Wuhan virus. This after Trump called it the Chinese virus in press conferences last month.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. It comes from China. I want to be accurate.
The FBI has warned of an increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans and is investigating a stabbing of a family in Texas. Eula Biss stands firmly against the war metaphor because she thinks it can lead to xenophobia and racism, and also because it shrinks our vision of the crisis. She's the author most recently of On Immunity and Inoculation, a historical and linguistic exploration of our attitudes towards disease and each other.
Viruses don't have nationality. They don't have politics. This virus does not have intent. It can't be negotiated with. There will be no truce. This is part of why it's a bad metaphor. None of the situations that we would expect from war translate.
The effort of the Trump administration to call this the Wuhan virus in international forums, you note in your book that syphilis was always attributed to another nationality.
Susan Sontag notes that syphilis was French to the English, German to the French, and the Chinese disease to the Japanese. But there's many other diseases that were thought of as being from or belonging to a different nationality. Near the turn of the century in America, there were people who believed that only Black people could carry smallpox. Mm. And that led to the forcible vaccination of African Americans.
You offer a wonderful exploration of the word immunity, better metaphors for thinking about it. The idea of health as being like a public bank, immunity like a public square.
And we're seeing that illustrated right before our eyes now. You know, in order to maintain a level of immunity within the community, everyone has to cooperate. I think refusing to participate in collective protection from disease it's antisocial. Especially in this country, it's a manifestation of privilege to rely on the risks that other people have taken in terms of vaccinating themselves and their children, and to not take that risk yourself. It's not tenable. This is now very obvious as disease spreads quickly across the globe. No place is remote enough that it's not going to be touched by this disease. People might feel off the grid or removed or out of the way. That's a psychological mirage. And so is individualism, actually, in this context. In terms of our relationship to disease, We are not freestanding individuals. We're always in relationship to other people and other people's bodies. And our health very much depends on what other people do.
The polio pioneers in 1954, that wasn't long after the war, you suggested that the polio pioneers had a sense of responsibility to the community that we don't have today. But we're talking about 650,000 children from all over the country who are volunteered by their parents to test the first polio vaccine. That's a stunning number.
You know, initially when I first learned about the polio pioneers, I found it hard to imagine. It's now not as hard for me to imagine, I have to say. And I was just talking to my stepmother, and she was describing to me a summer in her childhood in the Bronx when she couldn't play in the water sprinklers in the public parks because there was a polio epidemic. I think now it's a lot easier to understand, beyond a sense of national responsibility, why people might line their children up for totally self-interested reasons as well. This is what social life depends on. We depend on other people fulfilling their basic duties.
That would strike me as a reason why perhaps the war metaphor is useful. You quote Susan Sontag. She wrote, "Abuse of the military metaphor may be inevitable in a capitalist society in which it is thought foolish not to subject one's actions to the calculus of self-interest and profitability. War," Sontag suggests, and you write, "is one of the few activities in which we're not expected to consider practicality and expense. Declaring a metaphorical war on a disease is how we justify the expense, the impracticalities of protecting the most vulnerable among us."
Yes. We need some way of justifying actions that don't have the usual justification. And the usual justification is self-interest or profit.
We aren't making decisive moves nationally to cope with climate change. We were slow on Katrina and Hurricane Maria.
Yes.
Going back to your observation about Sontag, she doesn't like the metaphor, but at least it gets us to spend money.
Right, right. But I think that there are still better metaphors that we could use to communicate the same thing that is being communicated when we speak of it as a war, while also avoiding this idea of an imagined enemy and a kind of exaggerated nationalism that might come with that.
You mentioned nationalism. When immigrants are described as bacteria, then you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. We translate information that we learn about our bodies being under threat to our nation being under threat. And that happens at a level of thought that is not entirely conscious. James Geary wrote a very beautiful book called I Is an Other, a treatise on metaphor. He writes, "Our metaphors prime how we think and act." That idea of a metaphor priming your thought was actually explored in a study that he talks about in that book. Two groups of people were asked about their attitudes towards immigration, but before they were interviewed, one group was given an article to read that described airborne bacteria as harmful. And the people who read that article were more likely to express negative attitudes towards immigration, in part because of the already existing metaphor of the nation as a body. And, you know, this is one of the reasons to put an effort into avoiding the war metaphor, because we're quietly giving our minds instruction on how to think. And that thinking translates into action. I truly believe that the wrong language, the wrong words will lead you to the wrong thought.
You mentioned that you were motivated in part to write your book because the war metaphor is used to apply to any germs, quote, invading the body.
Yes. The metaphor that I find most productive around disease is the metaphor of an education. I was interviewing a professor of immunology at the University of Iowa, who's also an infectious disease expert. And I was asking him to give me a very thorough introduction to the immune system. This took about 2 hours. And he made it all the way through these 2 hours without ever once using a war metaphor. My favorite phrase that he used was that pathogens tutor the immune system. Even the technical language around immunity uses this metaphor. So we speak of immune systems being naive.
I loved that part. Immune systems of children, because they've had less exposure to pathogens, have not yet learned how to form the antibodies against them. Their systems are naive. And that's actually really useful in the context of coronavirus, because one of the reason it seems to spare very young children so often is because the naive systems of very small children don't overreact.
Yes, yes. And what's interesting to me is naive is actually the technical term. After I met with that immunologist who used almost strictly educational metaphors to talk about disease, I experimented myself with thinking and talking about my own illnesses using only educational metaphors. If I had a cold, I would have to say to myself, not I'm fighting a cold, but I'm getting schooled by this cold. The interesting thing to me is that it was really a different psychological posture. Changing my language changed my relationship to sickness and disease. If you think of yourself as at war, you feel embattled. But if you think of yourself as engaged in an education, you feel like you're making progress. You're getting somewhere.
Yet, of course, you know, the doctors and nurses on the front line, when they use the language of war, it's justified. They are embattled.
Yeah. If you're in a hospital in New York City right now, the metaphor of a war is going to feel pretty apt. Doctors are probably much more advanced than lay people in the psychological strategies they use to cope with being constantly surrounded by pathogens. You know, for lay people in the middle of a pandemic, I've been thinking about that education metaphor quite a bit, because it also seems to me that it could be extended and think, what can we as a country learn from this experience? Quite a few people have already made really interesting observations about our economy, who we value, who is essential, who's in danger in a situation like this, and who's compensated for that danger. We're in what might be called a teachable moment.
Eula, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Eula Biss is the author most recently of On Immunity and Inoculation, and she also teaches writing at Northwestern University.
Coming up, do we really need celebrities to tell us how they're sheltering in place? Can't they suffer, if you can call it that, in silence?
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.